Welcome to part two of our interview with David Omen about the ghosts of Cielo Drive.
We've kind of lost touch with the actual, spirits. We've turned them into demons. That's great and dandy for fantasy and fallacy, but it's not accurate. And these reality TV shows that are out there, again, aren't truthful and honest in their interpretation, because it's the experience of the individual that taints what the experience is.
Sure.
And what I mean by that is we have each and individual has one of three choices to any situation when you deal with it. I call it the three response choice. You have the stupid response, you have the fearful response, then you have the curious response. And no matter how many different times and ways people present their there's more than three responses, I say, really? I said, I think safely I can say that you can break them down to the basis of what they are, to the base points of what you're all saying comes down to one of three points of view, period. The stupid approach would be when you see an object, you come up to it and you don't know what it is. You just blindly, stupidly go up to the object and start fiddling with it. Now, the first thing that pops into my mind is the object could have a radioactive tag on it, and this person is stupid and doesn't know what it is, and starts meddling with it, and the next thing you know is the son of a gun's got basically radioactivity on his hand, and it's basically now giving him cancer all the way up his body, and he's going to die. Why? Because he didn't have respect and the cure and the sense of, let's see what this is, let's explore this with a sense of respect and sense of apprehension, but not fear. Big difference. Mm-hmm. And I'll get to the distinguishing points in the next person, in the next position. So that was the stupid response. Just don't even care. Just do what you're going to do and throw all care into the wind. All right, now we'll go to the fearful response. Comes upon this radioactive item, this box, say, and it's got the yellow and black insignia on it, and he's like going, oh my god, it's gonna hurt me, I'm gonna run, and runs away. And it turns out, if he would have stopped and just taken a look and said, all right, let me see what this is, let's deal with this situation, oh my god, the fear takes over, rational thought has been thrown out the window. So what you get is an irrational response without the sense of, oh my god, I'm with a sense of, oh my god, I can't deal with this. I'm incapable. And what happens? Fear takes over and they run away. Here's the curious response and the last response. The person walks up to this object, sees it, realizes it's got something that's not good, but it could be dangerous. Backs up and starts looking at it and tries to ascertain what it is, and says, okay, I see that there's something about this that is giving me a sense of foreboding. I'm not going to let that take over and throw me into fear and irrational response. I'm going to sit here and assess the situation. I'm going to keep a good distance, because if it is radioactive and it has a radioactive type of a tag on it, I'm going to keep a good distance, and then I'm going to call somebody up at, try to get in touch with somebody that is more knowledgeable than I am and have them figure it out and tell the proper authorities, so that nobody else besides me will take the hit if I'm exposed to any radiation. I won't allow others to fall into my pitfall, into my experience.
Sure.
See what I'm saying?
I do.
Where the fearful person puts everybody at risk because he doesn't take the time to assess the situation. He's now put others at risk as a result of his disability to deal with the situation.
That makes sense.
That's across the board from what I've seen, because I've seen that here at my house in 17 years with the different people's approach to the paranormal. And I've watched the different TV shows come through.
Sure.
And I said, where does the fear come from if the fear isn't there? If it doesn't exist in the situation, it's got to be created by the person, because I saw two people deal with the same situation at the same time. One had a meltdown of massive proportions and flipped out and started stuttering, blubbering fool. The other one was like going, oh my god, what the hell is that? Now they're both there at the same time watching the same incident take place. That's my point when I said to you, wow, it's all about perception and dealing with the situation that counts.
what made you decide to build on this road with your father? And let's talk about that process as it began and when you started to experience some things that maybe you weren't expecting.
All right. The story goes like this. I want to first tell the audience, I did not and have not, and I'm not a huge, big Sharon Tate fan. Mm-hmm. So I want to put that myth to rest that I bought this property specifically so I could build a house that would be in close proximity to the Sharon Tate murders.
Sure.
And I think that that's where we really need to begin from, because a lot of people are under the belief that I bought this property with the intentions of having my property, my home, right near the Sharon Tate murder site. That is not the case.
Okay.
In 1998, late November, Christ almighty, in about 2 weeks, it'll be 21 years ago, my father called me up. It was about a week before Thanksgiving, I do believe, on a Sunday morning at 8 o'clock. My father calls me up and says, "Get up." I said, "What? What, Dad? It's Sunday. It's eight in the morning. What's going on? I want you to get up and meet me. I found a lot." It's like, "Oh, Dad. All right. What? It's $40,000. It's like, "Oh, that's good. That's great. Where's he?" Goes, "It's in Beverly Hills." I said, "Uh-huh." I said, "Yeah, a lot." I said, "Dad, what does it say? 40K on the ad?" He goes, "Yeah, it's in the Sunday Classified, LA Times." I said, "Pops," I said, "it's got to be a misprint. It's probably 400K. He goes, "No, it's a foreclosure. I'm telling you, it's $40,000. Go up and here's the address. Meet me up there in 20 minutes.
Sure.
I'm like, "Oh, God. All right. "Fine, Dad, fine. All right, I'll meet you there. Let's take a look. I hope you're right." I said, "It's got to be a vertical slope. I'm sure it's nothing that worthwhile." Mm-hmm. And he says to me, he goes, "Just go there and meet me." So I drive up. As he gives me the street name, it doesn't resonate with any conscious thought saying, "Oh, wow, it's Cielo Drive, Sharon Tate." So I'm like, "Oh, right, fine, Dad, fine." So I get up here and I look down the end of the street and there's a construction site going on. And all of a sudden I start having flash memories of being on this street in high school some 20 years earlier. And I'm like, "Oh my God, this is the street. I haven't been here in 20 years. This is it. There's where Sharon Tate's house is." "But it doesn't look like it." "Why?" "Because where Sharon Tate's house was 4 years earlier was destroyed and demolished. So now at the end of the road is a big, big, big wrought iron gate. And beyond that, it's just basically dirt. There's no pavement. It's just," and I'm looking there going, "Oh my God." And so my dad drives up and my dad's 82 years old at the time. And he gets out of the car and said, Dad, that's where the Sharon Tate murders took place, at the end of the street here. I can't believe we're up here. I haven't been here since high school." And he goes, "I don't give a fuck. I don't care."
Excuse me.
Sure.
He goes, "I don't care about the Sharon Tate murders. We're here to look at this property." And he points to the slope to my left. And I look and I go, "Oh." And I go, I said, "That's interesting." I said, "Well, it's a nice slope." I said, "Dad, it's pretty gosh darn steep, you know. And it must have been about a 45-degree angle on the slope." And I'm like, "Wow, that's – and he goes, "David," goes, "don't you see what I see?" I said, "What?" He goes, "There's rebar on top of the dirt going down the slope." And I say, "Oh, wow." I said, "Yeah, between the weeds." And he says, "Somebody was here building this house apparently some years earlier, and they got stopped." He goes, "Because if I see what I think I see, the only reason why you would have that steel on top of the earth is because you have something in the earth that is tying to, and that's the beginning stages of a foundation to be building a house." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, "You're kidding." He goes, "Well, why else would you?" I said, "Yeah, you're right, Dad." And my father was a builder, so he used to build houses on slopes, hillsides, and whatnot. And he was very much, how should I say, not an expert, but pretty good adept at building houses on hillsides. And he says, "If that's what I think it is, that means that they've got the caissons in the earth, which are 3-foot diameter holes dug into the ground with a huge drill about 20 to 30 feet deep till they hit bedrock. Then they put in a cage of steel going down and then pour concrete into it. And those are basically the caissons that sit in the earth that the foundation rests upon. And he says to me, he goes, if those are there, David, and this property is only $40,000, he goes, there's about $100,000 worth of improvements off the bat included in the land, in the value of this property. And I'm like, holy crap. He goes, if I can get this for the right price, we can build on this. And his thought was, we can build this house and we can sell it. And I'm thinking, I've waited all my life to build a house with you that I'm going to end up living in. And I have no intention of spending 3 years building a house to sell when this will probably be the last house you'll ever build. And when I said he was 82, he was 82 numerically, yes. But he looked like he was about 60 and he acted like he was 40.
Okay.
I mean, my dad was a my father was Pistol Pete, was pissing Pistol Pete. He used to piss vinegar. He was such a character. I mean, I can't tell you. I mean, there's stories of my father. I got to write a book about the stories of my stories of my dad, because he would take me to Vegas when I was like 21, 22 years old to go play, to gamble, because he loved going to Vegas and gambling. He goes, come on. And then sometimes he would go to Vegas and he would come back, you know, he'd go on a solo trip to play and come back and say, oh, I met this girl. I want you to give her a call. I'm like, what? I'm like, yeah, I met this 25-year-old girl on the flight to Vegas and I told her about you. And I'm like, what? And yeah, sure enough, my dad was playing, you know, field goal for me, because he would go to Vegas and he'd make some girls like, here's my son. He goes, what you guys should get together. So I'd go to Vegas and I'd have a date set up. It was just like, you didn't have a wingman like I had in my father when I was a kid, I'll tell you. Wow. I mean, it was just the funniest thing. So he was a character. So he says, you know, if we can do this, and I'm thinking, yeah, if we can do this, Dad, I ain't selling the goddamn house. That ain't happening. No, we're not selling it. And I told my mom this, and my mom said, shut up and don't say a word. He goes, I'm not going to let this happen to you either. He says, I'm not going to let him spend 3 years building a property. I said, this is a steal. Why would I want you to sell it? She goes, no, absolutely not. So we bought the lot in January of 1999. And for the next three and three quarter years, because the house wasn't finished until August 30th, 2002. So during the time of the 3.5 years, I had plenty of experiences here on site, because I was working at building the house. And I myself felt energies that would be noticeable to anyone. And not in a bad way and not in a threatening way, just like they're watching, you know, watching patiently this house being built. And they're checking out. They're like almost like foremen. Like I'd be walking around the property on the different floors and I'd almost feel like somebody walk up right behind me and stop. And I turn and say, yeah, Jose, and there'd be no one there. And it was uncanny. I can't tell you how many times during construction I'd walk around the house and the different floors and just be like, and feel like somebody was sitting right behind me, about to tap me on the shoulder, and I would turn out there'd be no one there. And I wasn't the only one, because the laborers had strange stuff happening with tools moving from one room to another during construction. At the end of the major construction, when we started going into the finishing stages and we were done with the rough construction, I basically assembled the 6 contract laborers that were here and asked them what if they had had any strange experience over the past 2.5 years during construction. And one guy told me, he says, yeah, 6 months ago in July, I was down in the third level working, and I heard voices and footsteps coming from the top floor. And it was about end of the day. I was the last person on site. It was July. It was hot as all hell. It was about 90 degrees. And I went running upstairs to see if it was you and your father. And I got up there and there's no one there. So I go out onto the driveway. He says, he looks up and down the driveway and says, there's nothing, not a car, not a soul. So he goes back downstairs and he starts working. He says 5 minutes later, again, he hears voices and footsteps coming from the top floor. So he runs upstairs again, looks around, nothing there. He said, that's it, I'm done. He decides he's going to go pack his bags up. So as he's packing his bags up in what is now the guest bedroom on the third floor, he hears footsteps coming down the spiral staircase. And he says it sounded like leather-soled shoes going down the wood, hitting each one of the treads as it got louder and louder till it got to the bottom of the landing and it stopped. At which point he rushed out of the room and he looked 10 feet in front of him and saw nothing. And then he says the strangest damn thing happened. This kind of like an ice-cold breeze, but he says it's not over the entirety of his body. Literally, it's across the back of his neck. Right below the hairline, right above the shoulder blades, and it's chilling into the bone, he says. It's like a 2-inch wide blade of ice going right across him. He says, ah, he says, Dos mios, yame boy, which means, oh my God, I'm leaving. And this guy was 26 years old, from El Salvador, didn't know anything of the Sharon Tate murders, because I wasn't going to tell anybody, you know, that anything about that, because why bother? It doesn't mean anything. It's not important. It's history. Well, when he had this experience, he said he took off and he didn't come back for 6 weeks. I said, I remember that, because that's when you told the other guys that you were in San Salvador taking care of your sick mom. He goes, yeah. And he said, and I remember that because I was waiting for him to get back to put in the tile in the master bathroom. And because he wasn't here to do that, after the first 2 weeks, I was so frustrated and flustered, I said, I can't wait anymore. I said, does any of you guys here know how to put in tile? They said, nope. I said, screw it, I'll do it myself. Because I'd watched him do it a number of times. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, this is like cakewalking. You could do this. Turns out what looks easy to somebody is not easy to do if you've never done it before and you don't have 10 years of experience of doing it.
Yeah.
I swear to God, people laugh and say, really? I said, no, this is true. I said, if you don't believe me, take a little walk into the master bathroom. Hold on, Reggie, come here. I bring him in there and I say, look at the tile. I said, you've seen the rest of the house. Do you notice anything about the tile? And the first thing he goes, yeah, the pattern doesn't make sense. I said, that's one thing. I said, look close. And they go, oh my God, some of the tiles are a little bit taller than others and some are a little bit closer to the tile next to them. I said, uh-huh. I said, that's because I put the tiles in myself. And since I didn't know what the hell I was doing and I thought bigger thoughts that I could do something that I'd never done before with ease was a full fantasy and fallacy, that the tiles to this day are in the most awkward pattern that they should have been in a pre-planned pattern before I threw them into the grout. I should have laid out the tiles. He said, and he looks and goes, you're an idiot. He goes, these are natural stone. They have a vein going through each tile and you're supposed to figure out like a jigsaw puzzle, the pattern to take advantage of the natural lines in the stone and make the pattern work. Not just put one that goes running a line going from the left corner to the right corner like that, to next to one that's going from the left corner to the right corner down. It's like, he goes, yeah, you're supposed to align them in a way that you have a beautiful pattern on the floor, not a mishmash like a gosh darn, like hodgepodge. And I said, I see what you're saying. And people go, I said, look, if you think I'm lying, I say, would you think you'd put that kind of gosh darn tile work in the master bathroom, the cornerstone of the whole bathrooms? It should be the finest of the finest in perfection. You don't do that in a multi-million dollar house. Seriously.
Yeah.
So when people say, I don't believe, I said, really? Come here, take a look. And go, okay, yeah, okay, you're right. You wouldn't, no one, what? Oh my God. Then I said, really? I said, yeah, it really happened. I said, this is my handiwork. This is my thumbprint on these tiles in this bathroom. This is David's bathroom, literally. People laughed. They said, okay, we believe you now. We believe you.
You're having the obviously the tile experience as the construction wraps up and you then begin to live in the property itself. What are some of the things that are standing out to you as you're confirming to yourself, or maybe you already did confirm to yourself, that there is certainly something or someone else there with you?
More than singular, I'd say a lot more than one. Mm-hmm. The day that I moved in, I just remember feeling like on that 30th of August, I grabbed myself a laborer and I got myself a trailer hitch, and I basically moved the stuff up myself and put it all into the house, my apartment. And I just remember it was like, it felt like I was welcomed home, like there was a welcoming party here. I didn't write it in the book, but as I think about it more and more, when I moved in, it felt like I was being welcomed home. And I think that was because it developed a relationship and a connection with the spirits during the time of the construction, that they saw that as much as they tried to kind of like, and I don't want to say spook me, but let me know they're there to say, hey, you know, you're not alone and we're not afraid of you building on this land. And it was kind of like going, I know you're not afraid of me and I'm not afraid of you either. Mm-hmm. I was like, you know, don't pull this kind of like, oh, we're here. It's like, I know you're here. I've known you've been around my whole entire life. Stop it. Don't act like I didn't grow up with this. Because as a child, I remember feeling like there were spirits around there. And I only lived about 2 miles as the crow flies from where I live now in the same mountain range as this. And it was like, as a child, I always felt, I was into archaeology and paleontology. And I literally one day, I think I was 7 or 8 years old, I dug about a 3-foot hole in the backyard of my parents' house to dig because I wanted to do an excavation. And I found, I recall, a bone. And I don't know what happened to that bone, but it was not a chicken bone. It could have been a human a part of the femur, as a matter of fact, because it was a big enough bone that it was not small. It wasn't like an inch. It was like 2 inches thick at the top of where the connection point was. So I don't know what it was, but it was like, and I remember thinking about maybe they're Native Americans here. And my mom said, oh, honey, there are no Indians here. And as it turned out, there were in that area and all over this area. So the fact that when I came into this house and I moved in, it felt like I was being welcomed home, that I had gone through the 3.5 years of building the house and knowing that the spirits were here and just moving in. It was like, and I remember saying, hi guys. I said, I'm here. I'm now in place for good. Mm-hmm. And it was never an issue of like them saying, well, we have to get rid of him. He has to leave. It was just like, okay, he's here. Cool. He's now in the fold. Now he's, you know, around, and they made their presence felt almost immediately, to the point where I remember walking around the house after I moved in that first night and seeing shadow figures walking around. And I didn't really want to make mention of this in the book because it wasn't so much important then, but I remember them being around. I could feel them. I didn't feel like, oh my God, I'm in this big house all by myself. And I know a lot of people going into a home that they've never been to before and they've never lived in, and they go in and it's an immensely large property that they get all tripped out. And I've had that experience in going to other people's homes. But for some reason, when I came into this home, it felt safe. It always felt like, we got your back. You won't have to worry about us or anybody else for that matter. We're around you to be around you because we honestly appreciate your point of view and your reverence towards us. And when I say us as the collective of them, I didn't know who they were. And I still to this day don't know exactly who all of them are. I knew a few of the players. I assumed that Sharon and Jay were probably around visiting and stuff because they're, you know, the tragedy took place. But I didn't know about the Native American who was later on reported to be here. But I felt that there was more than one spirit and more than just the spirits at the end of the drive. It was weird. I felt like it was almost like a party sense of energy here, and not in a bad way, but just present. And it was kind of not hard to get accustomed to. It was just hard to kind of like balance out and saying, okay, when you feel this kind of presence, don't be afraid. Just go, okay, all right, fine. You're here. All right, cool. Whoever it is, whatever. Nice to see you. And it became just kind of like happenstance where I would hear footsteps walking around. I'm like, all right, the dogs aren't walking around and they have paws. So when the paw hits the floor, it has a certain acoustic signature. What I was hearing were footsteps like human beings walking around at times. Mm-hmm. And it didn't bother me. It was just like, okay, I literally would say, okay, guys, I hear you. And I did that to calm my own nerves down more than just to acknowledge their being here. But at first it was kind of, it took me a little while to get a little bit accustomed to thinking, you know, I've been in places that were haunted and active, but I'd never lived in one that I knew was really that active. And I said, it's weird. It feels interesting, but I had to calm myself down saying, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. Tamper your nerves. Don't be too whittled to the bone, because if you do, you're not going to survive it. So I immediately started to gain a sense of acknowledge them immediately, not for them, but for me. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I was convincing myself, saying, it's okay. It's okay. Don't sweat it. It's just the ghost. And people looked at me like, I said, yes, I really said that and felt that because I needed to reassure myself first. They in the other on the other side of it was to acknowledge them, yes, but I had to reassure myself that I was sane and okay and everything was fine and I wasn't in any way in harm's way or anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Would you say you're very much at peace today living with them, just as if they were living people? Obviously, at one time they were, but they're just in a different place now.
Yeah, exactly the way I look at it and have developed that kind of a an approach to it is that, look, we're all going to die at some point. We all have an expiration date. Even if we live to be 150, at 151, we're not going to be around. So where does this irrational, fudgy, wudgy, stupid, pedantic, oh my God, it's a ghost, this Casper the Friendly Ghost response to an apparition come from? I don't know, but I said it can't work. Meaning it doesn't make sense that we're all going to pass away and we're now chastising and demonizing, literally and figuratively, anybody that has passed away before us is coming back to visit us, even if it was a friend or a relative or somebody that we loved. Where do we come up with this kind of like fear-based response? I don't know, but I don't live by it. I don't use it as a code of ethics that I would apply to my life in any way, shape, or form to dealing with the paranormal, just because I take a very solidly rational look and approach to things. If somebody killed somebody else and they're in the grave, wouldn't the person in the grave's spirit have an axe to grind, so to speak, with the person that put them in the grave? Now, I would generally believe that, look, if somebody slugged me and I'm still alive, I'd want to get revenge on that person. And I'm using it as an example, meaning that, you know, you'd want to take revenge. Why wouldn't a spirit want to take out revenge on the person that killed them? But yet you have people that claim that they're being tormented and tortured by spirits that didn't kill anybody that we know of. Now, here's the thing. We don't know everybody's full story that's telling these stories about their life and what they've done and what they haven't done. When we say that, you know, they're being tormented by spirits and we don't know why, we don't know the full person's history. But my point is that, rationally speaking, wouldn't Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring, Wojciech Frykowski, Abigail Fulgen, Stephen Parent have one hell of a big-ass axe to grind with Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, Leslie Van Houten, Charles Tex Watson, to the point where these people were incarcerated and sitting in a jail cell 22, 23 hours a day. Why the hell, and for how many years, let's say 365 days a year, for some 40 some odd years, 45, almost close to 50 years in some of their cases, why wouldn't the spirits of the deceased that were killed by them want to thrash, harass, take out their displeasure, their hatred, their animosity on those murderers while they're sitting in their jail cells in those confined spaces? Why wouldn't they? And if they did, wouldn't we have heard something from one of those murderers complaining over the past 40 some odd years that Sharon Tate's spirit is tormenting them and won't leave them alone and it's haunting them, et cetera, et cetera? Now, to my great recollection, I don't recall any of that happening. Now, if somebody who's got a bigger axe to grind than some Joe Schmo, anybody on the streets who didn't commit any murders and didn't send anybody to their untimely deaths, could possibly lay claim to the statement that they are being tormented, by a spirit that's unknown to them. I take a real hardcore rational approach to this, saying, really? So the fact that the people that have real access to Quine from the other side aren't doing these terrible tragedies, these terrible things that you're claiming are happening to you, and they're not doing them to the people that are in jail, that are the admitted, confessed murderers. Don't you think there's something wrong with that picture when you look at it from that perspective?
It makes sense.
And people don't like to apply rational anything
no.
to the paranormal. It has to be this, oh, it's going to be, oh, it's got to be this, it's going to be. I go, Jesus, you know, I remember as a kid, there was an old saying, an acronym called KISS, keep it simple, stupid. Meaning, if you got something to kind of a quandary, isn't it the smartest thing to try the simplest approach to decipher and to understand and make sense of something without going out to the extremes and going to the outer, to work from the end point, from the simplest to the most grandiose approach to understanding what's going on, to simplifying things instead of magnifying them and making them into a billion lines of information when it's simply ABC, not ABCDEFGHIJKLMNOPQ. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's simple. The simplest is usually the most accurate and the easiest to explain. But when you sit there and you make these statements that I'm being tormented by a spirit, it's really, and I go, why would some spirit want to mess with you? You didn't do anything. You really are making these statements. I think that a lot of these people don't want to admit that they're egocentric, that they're egomaniacs, that they're looking for attention. And in some way, shape, or form, they're asking for this to happen to them. Mm-hmm. They're seeking attention. And here's where I come up with that reference point. I've had enough people in the house through the past 17 years. And for the past 5 or 6, I've had the house has 19 HD, 3 megapixel, 1080p cameras with infrared capability and with audio throughout the entire inside of the house. Outside, I have 5 cameras running. On one occasion, there was a guy that came in here, a friend of mine. He's not a friend of mine, but he said to me, he came running up during an investigation saying, oh my God, something happened to me in the third level in the earthen wall room. We reviewed the footage. You can see him walking with about 5 or 6 people. The back of his collar of his shirt lifts up 1.5 inches on camera, on its own.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's pinched and it's lift up. He then literally, about 2 seconds later, starts taking his left arm and trying to reach over his back. And then he takes his right arm and he's trying to reach under and around under his back to get to a spot. You can see this on the video. We then look at his back, and right in the spot, right in smack dab in the middle of his back where he can no longer reach, he could never reach it with his right arm or his left arm, either up the, over the top or under the back, around the back. And there's a little red mark. And I looked at him and I heard a spirit say, he got what he wanted. And I was like, what the hell? What? And then they said he wanted physical proof. And I said, holy cow. And they said, with an attitude. And I said, oh my dear God, oh my dear God, oh my dear God. I said, okay. I looked at him straight in the eyes. I said this in a stern, firm voice, saying, you got what you asked for. And he looked at me, he goes, what with this curious look like? What do you mean? I said, well, I just heard. I said, you asked for physical proof before you went into the earthen wall room with a snotty little comment, with a little attitude in your remark. And you mentioned, you muttered it under your breath. His eyes popped. And he looked at me and he goes, how did you? And I said, how did I know, huh? I said, hey, is it true what you said right before you went in? I want physical proof. With that kind of a tone in your voice. And he shut the hell up. He looked at me straight face. He goes, yeah. He admitted. I said, well, you got what you wanted. The spirits were kind of like miffed that you think that you're going to push an agenda on them with an attitude. And you think that they don't hear. And you don't think that they're sensitive to the tone of your voice and your intention. I said, boy, you learned a lesson tonight that you don't mess with spirits and play them off as dumb. and insult them and incite them to push them into what you think they can't do. Mm-hmm. Don't test them, boy. They will show you that they are present, that they are capable and willing to accommodate snot-nosed commentary from people that don't believe.
Yeah.
And he goes, I am so sorry. And he says, I apologize. I was just being cocky. I didn't really think it was my first time here. I didn't think that they were real. I was just being a little, I said, yeah, well, you know, luckily they gave you a shot without hurting you. And he goes, oh, the mark didn't last for long. It was just a red mark where somebody basically pushed hard on there and pushed and rubbed against it. So it was a little note of saying, hey, yeah, well, now what? And he says, you know something? I apologize. And that was all good. So again, there was a certain amount of disrespect that then turned into respect and acceptance and acknowledgement, which was the whole point of some of these people that lay claim are, I want to say it, are attention seekers.
Sure.
In a sense, they want attention. Not all of them. I said some of them, like Zach Bagans, Nick Roth. When Nick was here with the show Ghost Adventures, he got a mark on his stomach. Same kind of thing. It was just a red mark where somebody basically pushed down and pushed and then rubbed their finger down against it to like say, here's a mark. We're not going to scratch you. We're just going to let you know that we were here.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't have a little bit more respect towards people and the dead.
So you're exactly right. How people treat them in a completely different way that you would never react or act towards a living individual.
Exactly.
David.
Here's another anecdotal one that I'll tell you about that, again, goes back to perspective and where you come from in your mind when you approach a situation. It's got to be about 7 years ago. Chris Fleming, the famous psychic, came here to visit, and I'm friends with Chris. And he came up to the house to do an investigation. And I said, Chris, let's try to do this. If we're going to do an EVP session, I said, I want you to be okay with this. We're going to record it on camera. I'm going to have a cameraman following you around, and he's going to record the session. I said, I want you to use your digital recorder, put it down, ask a question, give it 30 seconds of response time with saying nothing and no one will talk, and then play it back. I said, that way it's much more credible than doing what they did on Ghost Hunters, which is come out, did the recordings, went back to the studio. They then spent hours and hours and hours looking for and trying to find the electronic voice phenomena that they found, and then they process it and put it through a amplifier and through a system of different types of filters and whatnot to sweeten it up, to bring out the noise, whatever. I said, I don't want that. I said, I don't find that accurate. I find it disingenuous. I said, let's try it my way. And Chris agreed. Let's try it. Why not? What the hell? So Chris goes into the laundry room, and there's about 10 of us in the room, me, the photographer, videographer, Chris, and seven others. And we're in this area, and Chris does the question and records it and plays it back. During the playback, there's a voice, and it's not a human's. It's a human. It sounds like a human being, but it's whispery, and the voice is very clear. And it says, F you and die and get out. One of the onlookers in the group, this woman, said, oh, my God, it's a demon. And I looked at her and I said, excuse me? She goes, well, it's a demon. He's telling Chris to F-O and die and, you know, leave the house. And it's like, excuse me, but let me ask you a question. If you heard me say that to Chris, would you call me a demon? She looked at me like, what are you, strange, stupid, or idiot? She goes, no, of course I wouldn't call you a demon. I said, so, but you would have been basically not a party to the conversation. She goes, yes. I said, so basically, in other words, you'd be eavesdropping, right? Because this conversation does not have you as a participant. You're intersectionally listening to this conversation. She goes, yes. I said, so why does it have to be any different for the ghost to be saying that to Chris versus me saying that to Chris? And she stopped and she said, well, it's a ghost. Well, it has to be a demon. I said, really? But I wouldn't be a demon if I said that, would I? She said, No. I said, so why do you pass judgment on a spirit having a conversation with Chris, who obviously knows Chris because Chris has been here before, and you're not a part of the conversation, yet your dispersion is to cast judgment on a spirit who says the exact same thing that you said, that if I said it, I wouldn't be a demon, I might be a jerk, or I might have a conflict with Chris. I said, why is there a difference? The spirit is making a statement to Chris, and that's between Chris and the spirit. You're listening into it does not mean that you have an ability to make a claim, a statement that he is what he is. I said, that's religion. So I said, furthermore, that's religiosity speak you talk there with demon. I said, in spirituality, there's no such thing as a demon. I don't care who spouts their mouth off and decries that there's demons in spirituality. I say, not at all. In spirituality, there's energy. It's neither good nor evil. It's just there. It's present. If it's unhappy, it's unhappy, but it doesn't mean it's an evil spirit. I said, just because somebody was miserable in life and an asshole and calls somebody names does not mean they're a demon either. I said, people like H.H. Holmes are a demon. You could call them a demon, but they were just a sick individual. And when they died, their energy continues on as most likely a sick individual if it's still remaining around. Doesn't mean that they're a demon, though. Mm-hmm. I said, this has nothing to do with Satan or angels. And then they said, you know, I said, and she started looking at me, she goes, you know, you're right. I said, furthermore, I said, we don't know what the conversation was before this between Chris and the spirit. It could be a long-term friendship or disagreement. We don't know. And what happened is later on in the evening, it all came clear to me what this was about. There was a person there that I was interested in that was interested in Chris, this female. And basically, when the time came to wrap up the evening, Chris was going to drive back some 35 miles away to go to Pasadena. And I said, Chris, why don't you just cut leaving tonight and just spend the night here instead of driving back? It's too late. Upon hearing that, the individual, this girl, asked Chris 5 minutes later if she could hang out with him for the rest of the night, which basically burnt my tail feathers. And at that point, I realized what it was the spirits were communicating. It wasn't about a demon or Chris and this and that. They were looking out for my best interest because they knew that my interest in this girl was going to be plunged into the depths of despair because she was interested in Chris. And because I offered Chris the opportunity to spend the night, she ended up hearing that and took advantage of that and basically thwarted any, because she had no interest in me and was more enamored with Chris, mm-hmm. basically put the kibosh on me. The spirits were basically trying to safeguard my best interests and protect my heart against what was going to play out several hours later. So as I'm laughing here and thinking about it, it's true that the spirits had my best interest at heart. It had nothing with demonic. And they were basically trying to give me a heads up saying, hey, let Chris go back to Pasadena tonight. You don't want to feel this pain you're going to hear later on this evening when this person who you're interested in shows her true colors and ends up hanging out with Chris for the rest of the night and not you. and people hate hearing that. I mean, the fundamentalist, you know, ghost heads hate it because it really points in the direction of spirits do give a shit. Mm-hmm. They do care about me. They were looking out for my heart and protecting me. And we're not interested in kowtowing to somebody else and their whims. They were looking out for me, and it was nothing demonic about it. But honestly, when you look at it, it was quite conscientious. And when I think about it, I have to say to them, thank you. I only wish I had the intelligence at that time to understand what they were trying to communicate.
That wraps up part two of our interview with David Omen about the ghosts of Cielo Drive. Until next time for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.